The word truth, as we use it in the English language, actually means the fact about a thing, the truth of the matter. When we try to use it in a completely isolated way, when we try to apply the term truth to an absolute condition in which we cannot expect any direct interpretation or explanation, then at least theoretically the term signifies reality as experienced in illumination. Truth is therefore actually, in the most abstract sense, complete truth knowing. As far as we are able to judge from our perspective, there are very few human beings recorded who actually can be said to have achieved truth knowing. For it would imply the total absence of any element of error. And it would also imply that the individual possessed the capacities and the powers necessary for the perfect apprehension of a matter. Therefore, most persons use the word poorly from a semantic point of view. We can look around us on a rainy day and we can say the truth is it is raining. We will not be contradicted. But this kind of truth has a very little interest to philosophers, mystics, and idealists in general. When a truth relates to the obvious, about which there can be no debate, discussion, or conflict of opinion, then perhaps a better term would be fact. Many things are factual. Facts can be sometimes quite inspiring, but for the most part, facts are not stimulating because they are obvious and because they relate to comparatively dead matters. We can accumulate facts forever and achieve thereby an encyclopedic type of mind. But these facts seldom make us happy. They seldom inspire us to greater personal effort. They open very few doors of insight or understanding because facts themselves are for the most part static. They do not challenge. A fact is a thing about which there is so great an agreement that there is practically no need for further exploration of the matter. We like to think also of reality as often a synonym for truth. Reality, of course, is actually not a matter of perception. Reality is the nature of the thing as it is. A reality can exist without our being aware of it. It can exist entirely apart from our comprehension. Therefore, in religion, reality is often assumed to be the highest kind of state or condition which the mind can conceive. Reality is, in substance, the unchangingness of things. Reality is the core fact, but it is more than a common fact. Reality is the actual nature of the thing. Usually, as opposed to the concept of illusion. Illusion being a seemingness, a thing as it appears to be, And when we say appears to be, we generally imply that it is in this way recorded by our own sensory perceptions. Appearances can be perceived by our faculties, by various instruments of thought and scientific procedure. But appearances are not necessarily real. Therefore, against reality, we have illusion, which is the appearance, the fantasy, which is not real. Reality can perhaps be applied to the divine nature. If we are theists, if we believe in God, then we may assume deity to be the ultimate reality. If we are atheists, then we must assume that the illusion of deity, having been dissipated so that we no longer believe in deity, then this unbelief becomes truth or reality in the abstract thinking of man. So reality must be the thing as it is. If the atheist believes that the universe is without a spiritual factor, then for him reality is this absence of a divine being. Against reality also, we have the vast creation of appearances which make up life. And today in learning, there is this endless struggle between truth and error, between the fact of the thing, the reality of the thing, the undeniable nature of the thing, and the conflict with that which is of appearance only. Or as the classical Greek referred to the situation, the nature of being is the reality, the nature of seeming is the illusion. Now, if every phase of life, strangely enough, we live in a world composed of partial truths. We live in a world of facts that are not sufficient, realities that are not discoverable, truths that are not at least immediately knowable. Thus, we live in various degrees of the factual universe as it is abstractly defined. We know that governments, policies, philosophies, sciences, arts are all in the process of becoming. We cannot assume that any area of knowledge is as yet perfect. Perfection of knowledge is simply the exhaustion of ignorance. When there is no ignorance whatsoever about a situation or a fact, the fact itself is clear. This is the Buddhist point of view. The Buddhist takes the position that man can never actually storm the gates of reality. He can never proceed step by step, possessing more and more of reality. Actually, the human being does not attain reality by a direct road. If he could have done so, he probably would have long ago. But reality is the condition that is to be found only by the gradual exhaustion of unreality. For a long time, men believed the earth to be flat. And they made a great step forward when they discovered that it was not flat. Now, what they really did was to recover from ignorance. They stepped forward one degree beyond the previous generation. They discovered something that was not so. And the thing that was not so was that the earth was flat. This is not so. So by gradually recovering from ignorance, they achieve the state of knowledge. The reason this is difficult is because ignorance is itself a kind of knowing. It is a knowing of that which is not so, but it is still a kind of knowing. And no one is more certain than the person who is tied tightly into one of these patterns of wrong knowing. The enlargement of knowledge must always result from the acceptance of the fact that we are wrong. And this is where the complication becomes very difficult. We must outgrow error. To outgrow it, we must recognize it and depart from it. And because our lives are tightly involved in little patterns which contain large elements of error, we are constantly challenged to depart from traditional, acceptable, long-held, long-believed convictions. And we are inclined to be reluctant. A reactionary is therefore actually a person who clings to a previous standard of knowing. And a progressive is one who perhaps tries to go forward, but of course may likewise be wrong. The reactionary is wrong because he affirms one attitude. The progressive can be wrong because he may live only to deny the reactionary attitude and not have any closer perception of the reality. It follows from our common and general experience, therefore, that we live in a world in which what we call truth and error are bound together in a most complex way. For us, in this sense of the word, truth can only mean the reality of the thing, and ignorance, the lack of the knowledge of this reality. Actually, no ignorance is absolute. And as far as we are concerned, no knowledge is absolute. Consequently, every pattern of research that we carry on has in it a certain amount of truth and a certain amount of untruth. Very often, the chemistry and the combinations are so complicated that we are unable to disentangle them. Thus, we continue to cling to errors, even supporting them by the partial truths which we have already achieved. The individual who follows this pattern naturally has certain difficulties in his life. He arrives at conclusions with the aid of faculties that are partly right and partly wrong. If he is right in something, he likes to think he is right in everything. And when he is confronted with one of these problems, if the issues are somewhat abstract, and his error is not immediately obvious to him, he is still inclined to cling to the error and assume that other people are wrong. Thus, the mind itself, being immature and undeveloped, has neither the courage nor the insight to correct itself, and will plod on down through the centuries, trying to move forward heroically and at the same time held tightly in errors by our imperfect faculties. The ancients also held it to be true that many errors are sustained because they are convenient. The individual finds that truth is frequently opposed to his own personal likes and dislikes. Whatever the natural fact of the matter may be, is not always what the individual hopes it will be, wishes it to be, or requires it to be. Thus, there is a war on almost constantly between the immature faculties of man and their pronouncements, and the larger realities of the patterns of existence and their requirements. The person is therefore unadjusted. Unadjusted means that he is not living by the same code as the world in which he exists. He is not intentionally disobedient. He simply lacks the insight which permits cheerful and immediate obedience. What are the causes for the continuation of error in the world? The causes are, first of all, ignorance. For where ignorance exists, error is almost inevitable. Then there is a compound kind of ignorance, which may be termed stupidity. Stupidity is the individual who, having the capacities to arrive at certain insight, or perhaps having actually recognized realities, refuses to accept them because they are inconvenient. Consequently, stupidity can only exist where the individual is doing less well than he knows. To live below our own level of capacity is stupidity. Both ignorance and stupidity can arise from, or in turn give rise to, selfishness. Selfishness is self-interest. Self-interest is nearly always at variance with universal requirement. The individual, therefore, who is self-centered is depending for his survival, for his insight, for his maturity upon the weakest of all elements, himself. The wise person is not self-centered. He would like to believe that he is truth-centered. And he probably realizes that in a conflict between himself and truth, he can only advance if self loses and truth wins. But in many instances, the individual does not wish to face a decision that is so formidable. There are, of course, many pressures that assail the truth seeker. He very often does not have the courage or the discrimination to pursue his search with the constant and irresistible determination that can lead to ultimate victory. The enemy of truth in every instance is error, and error is most obvious in this world in the various institutions which it creates. Now, error is not malicious always, perhaps very seldom is. But error usually has to survive by a kind of stubbornness. The person who is wrong almost immediately brings himself into an unhappy relationship with reality. The wrong person, or the person who is wrong, begins to suffer. Things go badly. The various structures that he builds do not operate correctly. The various institutions which he founds fail of themselves in some respect. His business goes bankrupt because of the error in his own understanding or insight. He loses his family because of errors within himself. A system under which we live, such as a culture, may produce generation after generation of misery. But if we have not the wit or courage to realize this, then we have to continue to suffer. When things go wrong, there is something wrong with the patterns that administer them. An individual cannot be right all his life and be miserable all his life. A civilization cannot fall as the Roman Empire did because it is right. Something has to be wrong. Now, in life, every time we make a mistake, we are jogged, but nearly always we neglect the warnings. We do not recognize that the difficulties that arise are the result of the fact that we are practicing an error, that we have a mistake of basic judgment, that something we are doing is inconsistent with the truth of the matter. Now, one thing that the Greeks discovered after a certain period of mentation, they gradually developed their philosophy, is that everything that exists has an archetypal pattern. This is true not only of animate things, but of inanimate things. Not only the works of God and nature, but also the productions of human ingenuity. Everything has rules. And these rules operate if they are followed and obeyed. A plumber has to follow rules, or the plumbing in the house will not function. The electrician has to follow rules, or he may short-circuit an expensive system and destroy himself. Everything in nature, or produced by human ingenuity, has a better and a worse way of being done. Everything that is created by nature is created naturally, and with the law as a primary consideration. But nature is not perfect. Nature is creating under law also. And the law under which nature is creating is the law of evolution, or the law of causality. We know that nature makes mistakes, simply because nature is working with elements and materials that are themselves imperfect. But when nature does make a mistake, nature very quickly corrects that mistake. For the mistake itself in nature does not survive long. Man, however, has discovered various artificial means of perpetuating his own mistakes. He can bolster them up. He can fortify them in various ways. If he has a bad law, he can amend it. He can create new regulations to support a basic regulation that itself is wrong. Ultimately, this will result in a pyramiding of corrections, and at last, the whole thing will collapse. So in the development of all things which man does, there are laws which, if fulfilled, bestow a measure of survival. But according to man's own development, nothing that he can create today is perfectly done. Therefore, nothing that he can create is eternal. The fewer the errors, the longer the survival, or the more completely the device will function. If man is able to create a better government, it will last longer than a poorer one. If man can discover a better remedy for an ailment, the percentage of recoveries will be greater. But man cannot as yet create the ultimate remedy for anything, nor can he fashion any institution that is immortal. The reason being that his imperfect insight will not allow him to be right in everything. And wherever his dream, his creation, his invention, his institution exhausts its realities, it begins to be undermined by its unrealities, and so finally falls. This is not wrong, but it is, we might say, inspiring to modesty. It causes the person to realize more and more that he lives in a universe of incompleteness. If it was not for incompleteness, our scientists would not be continually trying to find new solutions to things. Our philosophers would not be complaining about the fact that our higher reasoning processes are not adequate. Our religionists would not be trying to save us forever from sin, and our politicians would not be forever exploiting our ignorance. All of these situations point clearly to the imperfectness of things. We are all weak in the area of our errors. We are all strongest in the area of the degree of realities or truths which we have achieved. Now, man is confronted with two problems which also concern him. The first is, how can he make the greatest adjustment at this time between his realities and his unrealities in order to live to the maximum of his insight. How can he live to the full degree of that part of truth which is known to him? The answer, of course, theoretically is that man would have to live the highest known standard, that which is the most completely enlightened pattern of existence which he is capable of understanding. This, in turn, would require that the individual would have the insight necessary to determine that which is the highest pattern. We have today in the world many different patterns of ethics, morality, religion, culture, philosophy, psychology. Each of these, in its own small world, feels not only its uniqueness but its superiority. Thus, there is no agreement, actually, as to what is the best pattern. The reason there can be no agreement is that there is no mind yet capable of the complete discovery of the best. All minds are working gradually from the worst toward the better, but nothing has achieved the best. Also, if by some chance we might assume that an isolated person should achieve the best, then we would be confronted with the fact that no one else would understand him, simply because they cannot understand more than they are. To discover that which is the better or the best of the known or the attainable means that something has to be done to the mind itself. We know, for example, that the mind of man is an instrument of comparisons. Some of the older scholars believe that the human brain was divided into two lobes in order that on the two sides the various powers of the mind might be heralded or arranged in battle array to fight with each other. In other words, the armies of thought were drawn up facing each other as upon an ancient battlefield, and the mind fought it out in terms of the balanced competitiveness of the halves of the brain. We're not quite sure that this is so, but it still remains that the process takes place, whether it has anything to do with brain structure or not. In man, there is a continual warfare on the basis of his own competitive estimations of things. He thinks in terms of polarities. He thinks very largely in terms of Aristotle. He says to himself, if this is good, that which is the opposite of it must be bad. If a certain thing seems to be true, then the opposite of that must be untrue. So we create these competitive patterns. If one person's music is good, another type of music is bad. We know this is not quite true. We know that there are many kinds of music that are appreciated by different peoples. One evening I happened to attend a concert in which an East Indian musician and an American soprano constituted the warring team. Each one appeared on the program in high conflict with the other. To the East Indian person, the American soprano's singing was utterly incomprehensible. They could only explain it as noise full of holes. The reason it was full of holes was because it had pauses unknown in Oriental music. The Oriental finds some way of breathing without stopping his tune, either by means of his background instrumentation or something. There are no pauses such as we know. To the Western soprano, the Eastern music was equally incomprehensible. The quarter tones and the eighth tones had no correspondences in our system, and there was actually no understanding likely to create appreciation. each was functioning from the concept that their own was good, and that the opposite simply could not be good. We do the same in philosophy. We do the same in every branch of learning. If a certain thing is accepted, something else is not accepted. And most of our acceptances and rejections are on the basis of authority or tradition. So that the individual does not experience much for himself, calling upon various available resources to support an attitude. He tries, perhaps, to be honest, but he cannot be honest about something in which his knowledge is inadequate. He simply has no appreciation, therefore no inclination to weigh honestly that which he does not appreciate. This means that all through the world and all through life, the person is combating that which is not his own with the courage and strength of his own acceptances. What we call truth and error, therefore, can often be merely acceptances and rejections. Acceptances based on similitude and rejections based upon conditions or dissimilitudes, things that are different. This means that the person who is trying to find out the values of a thing has to gradually arrive at a non-Aristotelian point of view. He cannot assume that his own point of view has to be right. He cannot assume that his own acceptances have to be the standard of right. He cannot continue to divide the world, creation, existence, into two structures, himself and everything else. He cannot divide it into two patterns of acceptances and rejections. He has to take the ground that acceptances are familiar, but that no individual has the right to a rejection unless he has insight into the realities involved. And the more we become aware of the realities, the less certain we are, and the less dogmatic we become in matters of rejections. We become more tolerant, more understanding, more appreciative as insight enlarges. The Eastern system of thinking points out that the only way in which you can get away from polarity is to reestablish a unity, the Pythagorean monad, or the one. And do as Pythagoras did. Consider the one the symbol of truth, and the two the symbol of error, inasmuch as the one is indivisible and the two is divisible. Whenever the Pythagoreans referred to the number two, they spat on the ground to cleanse their mouths of the word, because to them all duality was error. Yet we live by duality. We go shopping by duality. We try to choose among 50 different detergents which one is the inevitably best. We have a hard time because every manufacturer is advertising his product as the best. And the Pythagorean would explain to us very clearly that the truth of the matter probably lies in the fact that half of the detergents, which each one is better than the other, half of them are manufactured by the same company. So that you have beneath these differences the fact that essentially they are identical. And nearly all of the differences are imaginary. Yet persons can become addicted to these imaginary differences and swear for the rest of their lives that one product is infinitely superior to the others. Also, persons living in different areas may find the hardness of water a reason why one detergent might be more successful for them than another. But essentially, all serve the same purpose. And the competition is artificial. All division, all comparison, all competition in nature is artificial. It may not be among man-made products always, but in nature it is. Because in nature, the realities are never in competition to each other. They are always complementary. So the Pythagoreans and the Hindus both pointed out the importance of creating a unity and making this unity primary and allowing diversity to arise in this unity, but never permitting the unity to be divided. The human mind, working with truth and error, tried, of course, to tie it to a principle of good and a principle of bad. And we had theological speculation in which God and the devil were locked forever in the struggle for the human soul. This attitude is essentially fruitless. It contributes nothing to the final enlightenment of man. Actually, the discovery of the reality of the thing ends all concern about its truth or its error, or its reality or its illusion. Illusion is simply a misunderstanding of a thing. It is an appearance which in some way has been misinterpreted because the individual does not have the skill or the wisdom or the insight to interpret it correctly. The Buddhists are not too certain, however, that the tendency to illusion is essentially natural. They think that the tendency to misinterpret is founded upon some perversity in man's own character. They do not believe, that is the Buddhists, that man will go on year after year, generation after generation, misunderstanding the obvious simply because he is incapable of understanding. They are convinced that man misunderstands because of a machinery which he has set up in himself. That in a sense his misunderstandings are intentional, although he does not realize it. They believe that the individual is clinging to an illusion because he wants to, not because he has to. That there is some perversity in his own makeup that causes him to prefer error to truth. Now, what would be the cause of such perversity? One cause of it would be an unbalanced attitude toward life itself. A lack of grasp of value concerning life. And theory as related to this is quite different from practice. The person has a tendency to live immediately. He has a tendency to create a powerful partnership between his ego or his self-center and his environment. He wants as much as he can have for himself now. He wants all the comforts, securities, prosperities, advantages possible now. He wants to build a success immediately in this world. He wishes to dominate, lead, and influence other people. He wants recognition, he wants applause, he wants advancement. And he wants his own way. All these put together would be quite inconceivable if the individual, honestly examining the universe, realized that this was not the purpose for his own existence. If the individual was not able to justify his false attitudes, he could not hold them. Therefore, he must justify them. And the only way he can justify them is by distorting the universe around him. He must refuse to see certain things. He must misinterpret some of the things he does see. He must depend heavily upon false evidence. He must agree with people not because they are right or that he thinks they are right, but because he chooses to assume they are right, inasmuch as by so doing he justifies himself. Thus, in Buddhism, the problem of error or illusion rises from the person's own subjective desire to do as he pleases and to sacrifice always reality for the sake of expediency. It is very doubtful if a man like Julius Caesar, sitting down quietly, could think through his own career without realizing that he was wrong. He could not have gradually moved his own career to the crisis in which he died at the foot of Pompey's statue with the dagger of his best friend in his heart. Caesar could not have experienced this tragedy had he honestly used his mind. Julius Caesar was no fool. He was no coward. He was a brilliant leader, a very astute politician, and a very ambitious man. These various pressures with their conflicts should have enabled him to know what must happen. Yet he chose to ignore the very judgment that he possessed. The same is true of Napoleon I. Napoleon was not a foolish man in the sense of common knowledge. He was a skillful leader, beloved by his armies. He was a brilliant strategist. And yet he should have known, and must have known, had he thought things through, that the end had to be disaster. Why did he go on? Why did Hitler go on? Why did Mussolini go on? Fully aware that disaster was inevitable. The answer is only one thing, and that is the fulfillment of immediate desire. And that moment of glory that leads but to the grave was the most important thing. Mussolini said that he would rather live 5 years as a lion than 20 years as a lamb, and he had his choice. But he knew in his own heart that the chances were overwhelming that he would end in disaster. So the human being, having a degree of knowledge greater than his general tendency to guard and guide his career and character, chooses to forget what he knows and to keep his mind on impossible things. He is the victim of delusion, illusion. Or, as some have said, he is always strangely, superstitiously optimistic that although every person in history who has acted as he has acted has come to grief, his destiny will be different. We find this in family relationships. We find it everywhere. The individual cannot accept that the laws of common character and conduct apply to him. Buddhism and Greek philosophy also point out, therefore, that this confusion, this delusion, can only be overcome, can only be clarified by some kind of detachment. As long as the person is an absolute slave to his own ambitions, his own self-will, and the satisfaction of his own appetites, he will always come to disaster because he will break the rules. To find what these rules are only by breaking them is a very long and painful procedure. Man does not have to grow every inch of the way from here to eternity in pain. He may choose to do so, but it is not necessary. There must be some way in which the individual can really gain the power within himself to live according to the best of himself. He must have some way in which he can return this highest authority to the best part of his own nature. Both the East and West, in the religious and philosophical systems which they developed, agree that this concept is correct. There is a way. And because it is very difficult for the person to fight all of his faults and every problem that may arise in him, especially in as much as he is not sure which are the faults. In some cases he knows, but in other cases they are rather complicated. The answer has always been that he must reduce pressures. Pressure leads to illusion. Pressure leads to error. The individual who is angry makes more mistakes. And in trying to bluff his way through one difficulty, he creates five new ones. It is like the man who cut off the dragon's head, and for every head he cut off, seven new ones appeared. This situation of trying to fight the tendency to error has never been successful, because man has not the necessary weapons. He does not have that sword of quick detachment referred to in the Bhagavad Gita. He simply has another dull weapon with which to defend himself against his own errors. So in these different systems of thinking, the only answer seemed to be to reduce as far as possible those aspects of life which have to depend upon error for their attractiveness or their continuance. The person who is not overly pressured by false values has a chance of discovering true values. The moment he stops making mistakes, the processes of life begin to be more obvious to him, the real processes. When he stops making mistakes, he begins to get over being ignorant. And when his ignorance is all exhausted and gone, then his wisdom remains. For the struggle is against the immediate errors of the personality and the deep subjective realities which lie within consciousness itself. So in the Eastern philosophy, particularly in the old Hindu and Vedic rites, the individual offered up his entire personal life to the service of the infinite, reserving nothing for himself, and permitting the infinite life to manifest through him according to its own will. Now, today, a person who did a thing of this nature would probably find himself in many difficulties, and would also be ridiculed by other people, because he lives in a time in which false values are supreme, and true values represent very little which are attractive to man. The true person, the thoughtful person, almost inevitably has to retire from human society and live in a monastic or isolated way. But for many individuals, the gradual reduction of pressure results in a continual increase of enlightenment, a slow, balanced change of personal polarization. The real purpose, of course, being to realize that in a sense, truth and error are at two ends of a scale. And the point of equilibrium is the reality. That the real thing is always in balance, whereas the unreal things are always opposed to each other. Polarity itself, while a manifestation of existence, is not as high a manifestation as the fact or reality of unity. Unity is oneness, and all things in truth and essence and substance must be considered as one. To be one in yourself, you have only two ways of possible. One is to gather up all of your parts and make a unit out of them. And the other is to relax away from the power of parts until the basic unity reveals itself. In meditative disciplines, therefore, the mystic simply relaxes the disunity of his objective nature. He simply allows his ambitions, his attitudes, his desires, his feelings, his antagonisms to go to sleep. And in the sleeping of the divided parts, he experiences the basic unity that remains. But what is, then, this basic unity? What is this reality, which in some way must bind up the wounds caused by the conflicts of polarities? the only answer that the wise have ever been able to give for this is that this quietude is peace. That it is something in which man becomes aware of the possibility of a non-polarized existence. He discovers that as long as he holds his attitudes in suspension, he is no longer torn by them. He is no longer fragmented by these different pressures of his own nature. He also discovers that part of the answer is the intrinsic wisdom in him. In some way, we have a feeling that if the world was governed by the right people, it would be a peaceful, happy world. That if there was enough wisdom, enough understanding, enough love, enough insight in leaders, they could win and hold the devotion of their peoples, and that these various party conflicts are not ultimately necessary in government. In the same way, if some part of man, deep within himself, could be given authority over the rest, there would no longer be conflicts of thoughts and emotions. There would no longer be pressures for and against realities. There would no longer be a terrible tugging toward illusion. The individual would not want to sell his birthright for the bowl of pottage. He would not want these things if his own leadership was real. So the Easterner took the attitude of trying to find the part of self that was big enough to bind all the other parts together, to unite them. In uniting them, perhaps merely enlightening them, on the ground that the enlightened part will cooperate. The benighted part will compete. Non-cooperation with a true inner leadership can only mean lack of insight. The religious system that was created out of this theory, the meditational approach to life, therefore caused the yogin or the Vedantic student to try to penetrate into himself to a condition of samadhi. Samadhi involved a number of achievements. First of all, the student of it had to become body unconscious. He assumed a certain posture or asana. He assumed a posture in which the body was neither under tension nor without tension, because always in equilibrium the release is achieved. If the individual is too comfortable, there is no release. If he is too uncomfortable, there is no release. So the asanas or body postures of the yoga disciplines were intended to achieve the possibility of the person losing awareness of body. So in meditation, in yoga, first of all, the body ceases to exist. Incidentally, the same procedure is described in the Mahaparinirvana Sutra relating to the death of Buddha. He is described as passing through these stages to achieve the final liberation. But in the Vedanta system, or in yoga, the body awareness ceases. Now, what does this mean? How are we going to experience this in terms of truth and error, of reality and illusion? When the body consciousness ceases, what happens to the true consciousness? Well, the descriptions that are best available on this type of subject from those who have experienced them would point out that as the body ceases, the world body ceases. As soon as consciousness is directed away from body focus, the individual ceases to know himself as a body. He is no longer sitting on the earth as a body or in a chair. The earth, his body, and every element involved in human, physical, material existence, every objective procedure, ceases. The community disappears. The nation disappears. The world disappears as far as its physical constitution is concerned. And the meditating mystic experiences himself as a conscious being without body, without form, merely a powerful spark of awareness in space. Now, well, some have said that this is a form of auto-hypnosis, that it is merely a technical method for denying the existence of material life. The yogin, however, will never admit this. He will simply tell you that where your focus of attention is, there you live, there your problems are, there your difficulties arise, and there your struggles continue. And that actually, this entire world in which we exist is much like that described in Midsummer Night's Dream.